Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we are here until 5 a.m. It's Friday. That means Fly Jams Friday is coming up. 312-981-7200 for your requests. Straight out of context, Nick D Show Spies, You Big Dummy, all of the regular Friday features will be coming up. We're also going to be talking about great movie mistakes and movie continuity errors that are hilarious, and we can point some of them out. And if you guys have any great ones, we want to hear from you on that. So that's all coming up. But right now, we want to welcome back to the show Brad Schreiber, who is the author of What Are You Laughing At? How to Write Humor for Screenplay, Stories, and More. He is also the co-author of Where's My Fortune Cookie? With Phil Proctor of the Fireside Theater. And Phil's been on the show a couple of times to talk about that book, and we had Brad on too. And we're going to talk about comedy and his books and all that great stuff. And let's welcome Brad Schreiber to the show. Brad, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Nick, thank you so much. Happy holidays all over you in there, Chicago.
There you go. Well,
get
listen,
this stuff off of me.
Well, listen, let's before we jump into some of your books and What Are You Laughing At, which we talked a little bit about the last time you were on the show.
Yeah.
Give everybody your background and where you're from and how you got into comedy and all that.
Oh, my God, a psychotic background, but I've enjoyed every minute of it. I mean, you just run-of-the-mill screenwriter, producer, actor, playwright, consultant, author, you know. Born in New York City, I've worked with some really phenomenal people. You mentioned Phil Proctor, who was my idol when I was going to San Francisco State University, Fireside Theater.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've also gotten to do playwright work with Sam Shepard, and Edward Albee gave me a residency. I did radio with some really cool people, including the engineer for Stan Freberg, Carson Taylor. It's just been one of those weird lives. And one of the joys of it is when you love somebody, you suck up to them and go, hey, how'd you like me to write your book?
Or
as a journalist, you go, oh, man, I would love to write about you. How about I put you in, you know, this magazine or this newspaper? So you get to fulfill a lot of fantasies that way.
And so you're all over the map. Now, did you, you know, you mentioned Phil being, one of your heroes. What other comedy got you when you were younger that really sort of influenced you and that has stayed with you throughout the years?
All right. I can tell you that visually, Ernie Kovacs stunned me. Now, we're talking about black and white television. That's how far back we're going.
Yeah.
But his sight gags, to me, were things that were used years later in things like Laugh-In. They were stealing ideas out of him.
Yeah,
really struck me.
He was a true innovator. I mean, he was one of the most innovative men to ever, you know, like the medium of television changed because of him. He was brilliant.
Yeah, I remember one bit he did where there were some gunfighters who were, you know, of the Old West shooting at each other, and he had a camera angle where you were looking through the holes in the guy's torso at the other guy who shot him. And the guy with the bullets in him is looking down like, oh, geez, this is really a pain in the neck.
Yeah.
He just phenomenal stuff. Or a periscope coming out of a bathtub that a woman is taking a bath in. He was just so imaginative and died tragically, in an auto accident.
Yeah.
On Beverly Glen, you know, not far from where I live, but he was just phenomenally gifted, and he's one of those people who opened my eyes to the possibilities of what comedy could be. In terms of stand-up, of course, Lenny Bruce, and then I think George Carlin probably worked more with language than any comedian who's ever lived. One of my favorite lines, because I'm very political, Nick, is Carlin's, you know, even in a fake democracy, we deserve the illusion of freedom every once in a while.
Yeah.
he was phenomenal. And he did something very rare in comedy. The older he got, the better he got. Usually comedians are like, oh, God, I got to crank out another hour of material. What am I going to talk about? He just got crankier and more brilliant as he went along.
Yeah, he was just as strong later in his career than he was early in his career. And it was always interesting to see, Brad, how you know, how his image so altered from when he first started. And the same thing with Pryor. Mm-hmm. You know, they were both sort of the short-haired, suit-wearing guys who didn't really work blue. And then they both gradually changed.
Then they both became dark blue.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, that's the thing about stand-up comedy. You're free not only to use vulgarity, but to use material that would blow people's minds in another context. I mean, I told your lovely producer, Dapper Dan Segrew, that I was working on a new book called Music is Power, mm-hmm. which is going to come out next year. And the reason I bring it up, Nick, is because some of these music acts really went against the grain, not only comedy music acts, but, you know, political music acts. And they were castigated for it. Lenny Bruce is a perfect example of that. If Lenny Bruce had been born 10 years later, he would have been blowing people's minds on HBO Comedy Hour.
Right.
Instead, he was, you know, basically skewered for stuff that now today we take for granted.
Yeah. Yeah, and
you've got to be born at the right time. That's the key to it.
Yeah, and again, but he is remembered. I mean, you know, it was unfortunate the you know, because it became about, you know, the controversy and him being arrested and being thrown in court and everything. And instead of doing the brilliant stuff that he was doing, he got sort of obsessed with that and talked about it on stage and everything. He read from transcripts and stuff from his court trials.
Yeah, not so much fun reading, you know, the last thing anybody's going to laugh at is, you know, reading a court transcript. But my favorite story about Lenny is that George Carlin saw him at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco. And was so blown away that, you know, that was one of the times that Lenny was arrested for obscenity.
Yeah.
So they throw him in the back of the paddy wagon on Broadway in San Francisco, and Carlin is so moved by the act that he jumps in the back of the police wagon as an audience member. And Lenny Bruce, of course, doesn't know who the hell George Carlin is. He goes, who are you and what are you doing in here?
Yeah.
And Carlin says, man, I was so moved by what you said on stage. It was so amazing. I just had to jump in here with you. And Lenny Bruce looks at him and goes, schmuck.
as
only
Lenny
time
Bruce
they ever met.
That's the only time they ever met. That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
You mentioned a bunch of the people that you worked with, and I wanted to, you know, that you actually had encounters with Sam Shepard and Edward Albee.
Albee was a huge influence on me because when I was in the San Francisco Bay Area, I saw him lecture at Stanford, and I told him I wanted to go out to his foundation in Montauk, Long Island. And he's one of these guys for me, he's still alive.
Yeah.
He was such a vital guy. He was like real cranky and real prickly, but if he liked you, he was incredibly loyal. And he was one of the first people when I was in my 20s who made me feel like I was good, that I could do what I wanted to do. And it changed my life because I had that inner resolve. So
yeah.
I always appreciated that about him. And every few years when I would go to New York, I'd look him up and go visit him in his insanely large Tribeca loft that looked like a modern art museum.
And so, in your relationship, you guys remained. Did you remain close throughout his or throughout the rest of his life?
Yeah. Whenever I went to New York, we would get together, and he was somebody who really was. He so believed that writers should be free to do what they do, and of course, in the theater. You have a lot of control over your work. You write for TV or film, you make a lot of money, and you don't have so much control.
Yeah.
And Albee was about honoring playwrights and what they wanted to do and not having artistic directors or directors of play go, yeah, it's a good play, but why don't you change it around and do this, that, and the other thing?
Right, right, right. And what about Sam Shepard? What was he like?
Shepard was, he was a cowboy. He really, when he taught at San Francisco, the Bay Area Playwrights Festival up there in Marin County, he was a cow. He just wore blue jeans, and he talked with a drawl, and he would talk about taking apart a play like it was the engine of a Ford truck. Mm. But he was really smart. His notes were really good. But he was quite a wacky character. I mean, he used to get drunk and take lassos and walk in downtown Mill Valley and lasso the parking meters, and the cops would go, "Oh, it's Sam Shepard. We can't do anything. Just, hey, Sam, how's it doing? You know, leave him alone. He's famous."
I gotta say, his death had a massive impact on me. I've done theater I did theater here in Chicago for a long time, writing and directing shows.
Yeah, I know.
And I was just devastated when he passed away. He was just such an amazing writer and wrote so many incredible plays. He was also a terrific actor too. It was just that was a big one for me when he passed.
Well, of course, True West. You know, I think a lot of people on PBS saw your Chicagoans. You know, from Steppenwolf. We saw Sinise
and Malkovich
and John Malkovich do, and they did a tremendous job. I was lucky that I knew Sam when that was done at the Magic Theater in San Francisco. The original production.
Wow.
And I had a friend in the cast, and that was pretty thrilling.
I remember,
so, you know, I remember it's fun, like I say, that if you play your cards right and you offer something to your idols, you get to know them a little bit, and it really makes your life a little more special that way.
Well, then that brings up Phil Proctor. Tell the story on how you hooked up with Phil, and then ended up co-writing that terrific book, Where's My Fortune Cookie, with him.
Oh, thank you. Well, I loved Firesign Theater when I was in the Bay Area. I was on a PBS station, and every year we'd review their Halloween show. And when I came down here, my accountant knew Phil Proctor. And I put him in my book, Stop the Show, which is a book about everything that's ever gone wrong during live theater in the last 100 years. I put one of his stories in there. And then I started nudging him because he kept talking about doing a memoir. And I said, "Listen, it's time that you sit down and do this." And we probably recorded about 20 hours of him talking about some of his stories.
Yeah.
And then put it all together. And you know, the trip about that, Nick, is that it's so exciting when you suggest something and the person goes, "Oh my God, I forgot about it." Like, you know, I'm listening to WGN News before we go on the air, and your newscaster's talking about Maria Butina, you know, the gun-toting Russian spy.
Right.
Well, Phil Proctor, when he went to Yale, was in the Russian youth chorus. They went to Russia in the 50s when we considered Russia totally our enemy.
Right.
And I reminded Phil that while he was talking about the Russian tour that he did with the youth orchestra, that Firesign had written a song called Communist Love Song, in which he talks about falling in love with a Russian communist girl. And he went, "Oh my God, we've got to put that in the book." He has written so much material that he forgot what he had done, and I got to remind him.
That's great. Okay, Brad, hang on, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, Brad Schreiber is with us. He's the author of What Are You Laughing At? How to Write Humor for Screenplay, Stories, and More. He's the co-author of Where's My Fortune Cookie with the great Phil Proctor from Firesign Theater, and that is a fabulous book. You can check out bradschreiber.com for more information, and there's a link on our Facebook page. More with Brad after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and it is Friday morning, which means all the regular Friday features will be coming up. Fly Jams Friday. Straight Out of Context, Nick D Show Spies, You Big Dummy, and much more. We're also going to talk about movie continuity errors and big movie mistakes that have been pointed out, and they're really hilarious. And if you've got any, we want you to jump in. Our phone number and text number is 312-981-7200. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. My guest right now is Brad Schreiber, the author of What Are You Laughing At? How to Write Humor for Screenplay Stories and More. And he's had a remarkable career, and we welcome Brad back to the show. Brad, welcome back, sir.
I really appreciate it, Nick. I wanted to add just very quickly a very obscure story about Phil Proctor. This is how outrageous those guys were when they start performing. They did a show at Santa Monica Civic Auditorium where they walked through the theater. They didn't start on stage. They walked through the theater, and they got these containers for bug spraying, you know,
yeah,
like exterminators.
Right.
And they had LSD on the side, and they were spraying the people going, we're going to have a great time tonight because we're all high. And, of course, it was nothing but just water.
Right.
But, I mean, that's how outlandish their ideas were as comedians.
It's interesting because when I've had Phil on the show a couple of times, I've had you on the show, and I discovered Fire Sign Theater right around the same time I discovered Python, and it was monumental for me. Looking at that stuff and going, wow, you can do this. That you can do this kind of stuff, and it was like it changed my perception of comedy completely when it went Python then Fire Sign like neck and neck when I first discovered them, and at a very young age too, at an age too young actually, I think, but it had a massive effect on me, and you know, I told Phil that too, and incredible stuff.
Yeah, well, if you're drawn to something that breaks the rules, then you seek it out.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I was in the San Francisco Bay Area, the local PBS station, KQED, would run foreign films. And so I was very young when I saw 8 and a Half by Fellini.
Oh, sure.
And I went, wait a minute. This is not a Tony Curtis comedy movie. This is not Doris Day.
Right.
Where's Jack Lemmon? It's got feathers and women and Marcello Mastroianni wielding a whip. What's going on here?
Yeah,
I kind of like it. It's not just because of the women and the feathers.
Yeah.
You know, I liked it because it broke rules about narrative.
You know, I want to get back. You mentioned the book Stop the Show, A History of Insane Incidents and Absurd Accidents in the Theater. I did theater here in Chicago for over 15 years, and both on stage and directing, and some of the things that happen during live performances are astonishing. Very quickly, we did a show that I wrote and was in, and I co-wrote and I directed it, and I was in it. It was called Here Comes a Regular, and it took place in a bar, and it was about these five guys who get together to console a guy who's just broken up with his girlfriend, and we had some people in the audience. The set itself was a fantastic set, and it was a bar, and people actually thought that was the bar to sit at before you walked into the theater. That's how good the set was. So we had some people in the audience, and they had seen the show before and they loved it. It was like four guys, and they came in and they saw it for the second time, and they wanted the seats reserved, so they reserved seats for them because it was general admission, and they clearly had been drinking before the show, and they brought in like big bottles of red wine. And at one point,
God,
in the show, and this was a very small theater, and in fact it was so small that pretty much the entire theater was lit. Like, you could see the audience was lit, and we could see him from on stage, like, clearly. And so this guy sitting in the third row, he passes out during the show, and we notice, like, he's asleep. He wakes up, makes a spectacle of himself, vomits all over himself, climbs over the people in the rows in front of him, staggers across the stage, goes through what would be the entrance of the bar, and where the bathrooms, the actual bathrooms in the theater were, and went back there, and then all hell broke loose. People were like, oh, we can get up and just do anything? And it was one of those things, Brad, here's the thing that came out of that, and I don't want to pat myself on the back, but when the guy came out and walks across the stage, with vomit all over him, staggers out the front door, I said to the actor playing playing the bartender, I said, man, you really overserved him. So we got a laugh out of it. We got a laugh out of it, which was good.
Well, that's the thing. That's why I did stop the show. Actually, that came out of seeing a friend of mine named Cyril in a play in San Francisco, a farce by Terrence McNally called Noon, where all these people respond to a personals ad. So Cyril is like 5'4", chubby, very hairy, about 50, balding, and he's wearing a leather S&M outfit. Looks like S&M Lederhosen.
Right.
And what he does... And he's a character in this play, and my girlfriend and I are going to see him backstage after, you know, and say, hey, nice job. The problem is he's running around, and one of his testicles pops out of his little leather brief, and he doesn't know it. So the audience is now laughing, and Cyril, not knowing what's going on, is thinking he's a Brit. Oh, I'm really killing them tonight.
Right.
God, I'm funny.
Right.
And and the more he jumps around, the more it bounces around like a piñata. And I said to my girlfriend, oh, my God, we cannot go backstage
right.
and tell him how great he was.
Yeah.
And B, why don't I do a book of nothing but insane real-life stories that show what actors and directors have to go through when things go wrong in live theater.
Yeah.
And I only wish I had known you so I could have included your great story. Maybe we'll do an updated version.
Well, I want to hear more of these stories, though, Brad, but I can give you another one really quickly. We did a show here called White Trash Wedding and a Funeral. Which was about as offensive as you can possibly get. I directed the show, and it was about 75 minutes long, and it was written as a two act, but I made it a one act because I said nobody's going to come back for the second act. Because within 5 minutes, the vulgarities go flying, the tasteless jokes, all kinds of bodily fluid. It is as tasteless as you can possibly get. So, for some reason, some people decided that they were offended with about 15 minutes left in the show. And so there's a scene where the pastor who is, you know, overseeing the wedding, and now they're in the reception area, is guzzling a big jug of Jack Daniels, and he's just drinking it. And while this is happening, these three people get up, and it's, again, the small theater, they get up, and they start to walk out, and they have to cross the front of the house to do the front of the stage to do it. So he starts to do that, and the Reverend stops drinking and looks as they walk past him and they're walking out, and he goes, "You're going to miss the cutting of the effing cake," as they walk, which was just brilliant piece of improvisation. But what was fascinating to me was. Within 5 minutes, they should have been offended. I don't know why they sat there for an hour. It made no sense. Sometimes the audience is just baffled me. I don't know.
Yeah, and maybe it just built up. They're disgusted.
That might be what it was, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Melinda Peterson, who is Phil Proctor's wife, gave me a story. She was in a play in Troy, New York, and it was incredibly hot. It was during the summer, and it was bad air conditioning, and she was playing a woman who is blind. And what happens is she gets a nosebleed because it's so hot. And the audience can see it, and she's trying to stifle the bleeding while pretending to be blind. And finally, the bleeding is so bad that a stage manager puts his hands between two flats and holds out a Kleenex magically. And she wants to play the reality of being blind, so she pretends to just casually reach out and go, "Oh, a Kleenex."
That's
and staunches the bleeding and plays the rest of the play that
is,
she's blind.
God, that's funny. So, that is so funny. And then, we're theater vets.
I mean, we see these things when we attend, even if we're not involved in the production.
Oh, yeah.
We see how people have to cover during mishaps. It's amazing.
Did she say how the audience reacted to it? Did they laugh or?
Oh, of course they laughed because they knew. But the audience also implicitly understands that, well, the show must go on. Stop the Show's the name of the book.
Yeah.
And the way, like, even the small things that aren't funny, like, I see a lot of theater here in Los Angeles, and when an actor drops a prop and continues talking, I'm fascinated to see how they're going to incorporate picking it up, because it's a safety issue.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, they want to pick it up, not immediately, because then it looks like a mishap. They want to pick it up when it's motivated by what they're doing or what they're talking about on stage.
Right.
And that intrigues me, not only covering up when, you know, a piece of property lands on your head, but also the small things and doing it in character.
Now, the unbelievable theater story, one of my favorite theater stories of all time, which involves Peter O'Toole and Richard Harris. Do you know this?
Which one is this?
Yeah, which one? Because these, you know, those get, well, they were in a play. I don't remember. Richard Harris told this story on Letterman years ago. And what happened was they were in a play together, and there was a period of time where they weren't on stage for a while. And then they didn't have to come back for the second act. So in the first act, they're out a little bit early, so they've got some time. So every night, they would go to the pub next door, and they would just hammer down. They would just hammer down drinks the whole time during intermission, and then they would get back in time for their entrances in the second act, at the beginning of the second act. So one night they got particularly, you know, sloshed during their little break, during the break and during the intermission. And the stage manager had to run into the pub and get them because, of course, everybody knew where they were. They knew that O'Toole and Harris were in the pub. And so the stage manager comes busting into the pub and says, "You guys are on. You're going to miss your entrance. We're starting the show. You're going to miss your entrance." And so they finish their drinks, of course, because they're not going to waste them. So they finish their drinks, and they run in and go into the theater. So meanwhile, the audience is just kind of waiting for the entrance at this point. And so all of a sudden, there's a big, you can hear foots running through the stage, and the first person who has to enter is Richard Harris. So Richard Harris busts through the door, is staggering all over the place, and slides, falls off the stage and into the lap of a woman in the front row. And the woman in the front row says, "Oh, my God, Richard Harris is drunk." And Richard Harris says, "If you think I'm drunk, wait till you see O'Toole's entrance." Wait till you see O'Toole's entrance. It's the best. It's my favorite theater story of all time.
Yeah, well, that's why I did it. And then Stop the Show breaks it down into, you know, things going wrong in terms of lines, props, the audience getting into fights. You know, remember Cats? I thought Cats was a terrible idea for a musical, but it was incredibly successful.
Yeah.
And what they would do is during the intermission, they would start Act Two by all the characters who are dressed like cats slowly walking on stage while the house lights are up, and then everybody'd settle in their seats, and then they'd start.
Yeah.
Well, they'd leave the doors open on the street where the theater was in the theater district, and a homeless woman walks right up the middle row and crawls on stage and starts like, "Meow, meow." And so none of the actors know what to do. Finally, a stage manager runs, and the homeless woman sees it and starts laughing and runs out a side door and is never caught.
Oh, God, that's
so that's
fantastic.
How they opened Act Two of Cats.
That's how they, which that's I think, fantastic. You know
which
what?
I think is a market improvement. I'm not a big fan of Cats.
Man, I can't stand Cats. And I was going to say, Brad, I wish I was at that performance. I may have enjoyed it.
I used to write a column for a paper called Entertainment Today, and when the end of Cats came, I wrote a column called "Why I'm Glad Cats Has Finally Closed." Not a great musical.
No, in
my view.
Did you get a lot of negative response? Because there are a lot of impassioned Cats fans out there.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, apparently it had more than 9 lives. It's a pretty awful idea, but, you know, a lot of people talk about some of the greatest artists coming up with clunkers like Starlight Express. Can you imagine doing a musical where it's a roller derby? I mean, who comes up with this stuff?
I know. And you know what? I saw that show. I saw Cats. I saw Cats at the Winter Garden in New York, during its heyday.
Winter Garden.
And then I saw Starlight Express in New York as well, and that was the dumbest show. I mean, that was even worse than Cats. And I was like, what is going on with this? There's tracks all over the stage and all over the theater, and these people in these, and they're supposed to be a train. I'm like, what the hell is this? It was just ridiculous. So, yeah, Brad, hang on, okay?
All right.
Okay, Brad Schreiber is with us. He is the author of several books, including the one that we were just talking about, Stop the Show, which is a history of insane incidents and absurd accidents in the theater. And there are a lot of those to talk about. We got more to talk about. We'll talk about some more comedy. And then, like, the book that he's writing right now, we'll get into as well. And we'll take a break here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. And we are here until... we're here until 5 a.m. Coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. But Brad, now I'm having a great time talking with Brad Schreiber, the author of several books, including What Are You Laughing At? How to Write Humor for Screenplay Stories and More. Brad, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Nick.
All right. So were there any other, before we jump into another topic, were there any other, like, really memorable, because, I mean, this book's, can you send me a copy of this book of Stop the Show?
You bet. Yeah. I would be thrilled to. And it was published a while ago. I'm happy to say it's done better than a lot of my books. It's been out, I guess, 12 years, and it's still in print. I guess there are a lot of theater people who like who like Schadenfreude, they like other people suffering while they
read
about their mishap. That's why I love those stories. They just defy belief, but they've really happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, even my own performing when I had a couple comedy groups in the San Francisco Bay Area, you know, we once did a small bar, which is kind of where Robin Williams got his start in the Bay Area, the Holy City Zoo on Clement Street. Mm. And I remember my group was performing, and all of a sudden a drunken guy at the bar starts singing some song he just made of, oh, you gotta take the beets and potatoes in the sack, and you gotta stay up late or you break your mother's back. And he's so loud, and no one will tell him to shut up, and the place only sits about 50 people.
Right.
That we just drop all the written material and we start improvising because we can't get this drunk to shut up.
Yeah.
So we start making up drunken songs. It's just, everybody has to deal with that, especially in stand-up. But when it happens in theater,
yeah,
it's remarkable because the actors are not trained to improvise.
Yeah.
They're working off scripts, and the way that they cope with disasters
is
actually a lot more impressive than the way stand-up comedians cope with it.
It's interesting. It really is. So listen, your next book is due out next year, and it's called Music is Power. Give me a quick summation of what it is and how far along you are and when we can look forward to reading that one.
Well, thanks. It's going to be out in November of next year. Rutgers University Press is publishing it, and it's just as it sounds. Music is Power is about the intersection of politics and political change and popular music, starting with Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, going through psychedelic music and comedy records like the Smothers Brothers,
yeah,
all the way through hip-hop. And tonight I'm doing research on Green Day and their musical American Idiot,
yeah,
which, of course, was in response to 9/11 and the war in Iraq.
Right.
So some of it's comedic, but most of it is about really popular music that changed perceptions and in some cases actually changed the law. Remember Phil Oakes, the folk singer, you know, he really motivated a lot of people, and he kind of made Bob Dylan up his game. Or P.F. Sloan, another great example of a guy who wrote The Eve of Destruction that Barry McGuire sang.
Yeah, yeah.
You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. Well, what happened is the 26th Amendment got passed partly due to the influence of that song. Mm. Nixon said, okay, 18-year-olds can now vote. I'm sure he lived to regret that decision.
That's true.
But there's a song, Nick, that actually made political change. So
yeah.
Music is Power is something I'm working on 7 days a week because my deadline's February.
And, okay.
And I'm very proud to do this book with Rutgers.
Well, I'm excited. I'm excited for it, as I am with all of your stuff. Brad, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, sir.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. I'm wishing you and all Chicagoland very Merry Christmas and a Happy Hanukkah and a Kwesi Kwanzaa.
There you go. Exactly. And a great new year. Same to you, Brad. And thanks so much
for joining us,
and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Always a pleasure, Nick.
Okay, take care. There you go. Brad Schreiber, everybody. A tremendously talented man and a writer and even more than that. What Are You Laughing At is a book about how to write humor. Where's My Fortune Cookie is a book that he wrote with Phil Proctor from Firesign Theater. And Stop the Show is a history of insane incidents and absurd accidents in the theater. A great guy. So thrilled to talk to that guy. All right, we got a break here. We got the news coming up next on 720 WGN.